loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We take a look at two big stories in our first hour. First, we hear from the legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg about his latest book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. The Doomsday Machine reveals shocking details of the U.S. nuclear weapons program in the 1950s and 1960s, a program that Daniel Ellsberg personally worked on, including how responsibility for launching a nuclear war was delegated to theater commanders during the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. No other high-level insider has ever written so candidly about nuclear war policy, and that policy hasn't changed in more than a half a century. In our second segment, we talk about the grave dangers posed by America's aging nuclear power plants. We are pleased to share a 30-minute excerpt from an interview with Kevin Camps and Greg Mello, two of the leading experts on this issue.
And in our second hour, we talk about the five big stories of the day. First, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, under fire from members of his own party for giving in to pressure from Republicans on the government shutdown, said yesterday that any discussion of a border wall is off the table. Others say Schumer had no deal with House Republicans to discuss DACA. Next, Google, for the first time, has spent more money than any other company lobbying Congress, the White House, and federal agencies. The tech giant spent $18 million to influence policymakers on such issues as immigration, tax reform, and antitrust law. Then, Puerto Rico's governor announced on Monday that he is moving to privatize the island's troubled public power company after its slow and difficult recovery from Hurricane Maria exposed mismanagement and corruption. And then the Turkish offensive in northern Syria continues to press forward against the Kurdish YPG's positions. Meanwhile, Turkey's foreign minister has claimed that the United States is in favor of a 30-kilometer security buffer along the Syrian-Turkish border. Finally, Pennsylvania's Supreme Court struck down that state's congressional district boundaries, calling them unconstitutional. While Democrats and Republicans consistently split the vote about 50-50, Republicans control 13 of the state's 18 House seats. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to a discussion with Daniel Ellsberg, legendary whistleblower and the author of a new book. In his latest book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg reveals shocking details of the U.S. nuclear weapons program of the 1950s and 1960s, including how responsibility for launching nuclear war was delegated to theater commanders during the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. No other high-level insider has ever written so candidly about nuclear policy, and that policy hasn't changed in more than a half century. We are joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Daniel Ellsberg. He is one of the most important, well-known whistleblowers in modern American history and the author of The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Daniel Ellsberg, a great honor. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks. Very good to be here.
Well, let's just talk first about what is the guts of this book, which are the documents that you had in your possession based on your work with the Pentagon. This was before the Pentagon Papers, I believe, but as a nuclear war contingency planner. Talk about the source of these documents, and then we want to get into what they actually say.
When I went to the Rand Corporation as a summer consultant in 1958, it was the height of the missile crisis, or the beginning of the missile crisis, but it never, and it actually did continue to grow wrongly for another year or two. And that was the idea that the Russians, who had actually launched an ICBM, an operational ICBM, in 1957, before we were able to do it, were ahead of us in nuclear missiles, in ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles of the kind that North Korea has been testing lately, much later. And we had, by 1961, we had about 40 such missiles, but the Air Force in particular was projecting that they had several hundred, and the head of the Strategic Air Command, General Power, believed that they had at that time 1,000. And with 1,000 missiles, the idea was, or even with several hundred missiles, they could totally eliminate our ability to retaliate, and they could launch a first strike in which there would really be no retaliation against the Soviet Union. The reality at that time in late 61 turned out to be that they had 4 ICBMs to our 40, not several hundred and not 1,000. Power, general power, was wrong by 250 times, not 250%, but 250 times the number of missiles they actually had, which meant that we had a great superiority. Not that superiority means very much in the nuclear era, but at that moment it did mean something. It did mean that with their 4 missiles, if we struck first, there might well be no retaliation against the United States. There could be some cruise missiles on submarines, but their 4 missiles would be knocked out very easily by a single strike. Now, that did not mean, however, that the NATO alliance would get off. We did contemplate the possibility of escalating, for example, a Berlin crisis, or the next year, the Cuban Missile Crisis, to a first strike. And in that event, Europe, our NATO allies, would have been annihilated by the Soviet medium-range missiles, intermediate-range missiles, short-range planes, missiles, everything. Europe would have gone, but actually Europe would have been annihilated in terms of our planning, as my book shows at the beginning, by radioactive fallout from our own strikes on East Europe and on USSR, with depending on which way the wind was blowing, which depended to some extent on the season that this was taking place. But we actually contemplated that if we launched a first strike, we might get off scot-free. That's what the calculation showed at that early period, well, or would have shown on late 61. But NATO in West Europe would have been annihilated. Now, Lindsey Graham was just saying that if we attack North Korea, he assures the American public and says that the president does the same, that all the casualties would be over there, which means our allies, South Korea, Japan. But he says, after all, the president is president of the United States, as he keeps telling us, making America great again, not our allies in Asia. And he kind of writes those off in a war. Well, that would seem just, incomprehensible, possibly, or all too comprehensible, maybe, to the audience he's addressing. But he didn't invent that idea. Back in 61, that long ago, we were already, in effect, writing off our Western European allies if we chose to launch a first strike, which we were committed to do in the case of NATO if there was a conflict over Berlin or Yugoslavia or Iran. But in the NATO alliance, which didn't include Iran, or for that matter, Yugoslavia, but we did contemplate the possibility we would respond to a Russian invasion of Yugoslavia. But Berlin was in crisis that year and the next. And had we escalated, as we were essentially committed to do, we would have destroyed Europe in order to save it.
Dan, you gave an interview to Democracy Now! Recently in which you laid this out in real specificity. And I'd like to read a short passage from your interview, because I think it's so important, and it cuts to the heart of what you're talking about in the book. It's something that I think every American should understand. This is what you said on Democracy Now! So I drafted a question, which the aide to McGeorge Bundy, Bob Comer, sent to the Joint Chiefs in the name of the president. This is, of course, during the Kennedy administration. And the question was, in the event of your carrying out your general nuclear war plans, which were first strike plans, how many will die? First, I asked, in the USSR and China alone, in the thought that, by the way, they'd be embarrassed to discover, to say, we have to have more time, we've never really calculated that. I was wrong, and my friends were wrong in the Air Force. They came back with an answer very quickly. 325 million people in the USSR and China alone. Well, then I asked, all right, how many altogether? And a few days later, 100 million in Eastern Europe, the captive nations, another 100 million in Western Europe, our allies, from our own strikes by fallout, depending on which way the wind blew. And however the wind blew, a third 100 million in adjoining countries, neutral countries like Austria and Finland or Afghanistan, then Japan, Northern India, and so forth, a total of 600 million people. That was a time, by the way, when the population of the world was 3 billion, and that was an underestimate of their casualties, 100 Holocausts.
So that's what the Pentagon planners were planning. In other words, they had these numbers, Daniel Ellsberg. They had those numbers. They got back to you right away and said, yeah, this is what's going to happen. We'll have 600 million dead. And they're still carrying out contingency plan, real planning for a nuclear war. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. And the reaction I had was that this was the most evil plan and evil preparations for war and readiness that had ever existed in the history of humanity. It would be easy to suppose that the people doing such planning had all to be monsters, freaks of some sort, but these were people I knew, and some of them quite well. I had dinner with them in the evening, drank beer with them in the evening. We worked hard at night. They were planners who were very ordinary Americans, smart, conscientious, patriotic, but normal in the sense of being like everybody else. And what that showed me, of course, was that you don't have to be a monster as a human to be doing and planning and threatening and risking monstrous things, which is what we were doing. They were following orders, the people I was working with, and this is the plan, how to do it most efficiently. So that was their job, which they did during the day. I didn't come to think that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were mad in some sense, that coming out of the Eisenhower new look, bigger bang for a buck days where we relied on nuclear weapons, they had just lost all perspective in a way that and by the way, it was the Joint Chiefs who were doing this planning, basically. It was done under them. I thought of them as actually mad dogs, kind of rabid. I mean, not in a rhetorical sense, but mad. And it was I knew that McNamara felt the same way about the plans, that they were insane and wrong, didn't make any sense. And that was the basis for my great loyalty to McNamara. I thought that he was the one with the will and the ability, executive ability, to keep these people under in rein somehow, in check, and to roll back these plans. Actually, he didn't succeed in doing that at all, to whatever extent he tried. Other priorities were greater. No president after him was really ever able to do it, too. There is a military-industrial complex, and its fruit is this insane, immoral plan.
You know, for our audience today, especially for younger people, they might not really get the idea that the U.S. was preparing for a nuclear war. I was 10 years old during the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So as a 10-year-old, as a boy, I remember vividly, as do all the other children of that era, and of course, people who are older even more vividly, the country really was on the brink. It seemed to be on the precipice of a nuclear war, and that the generals or the policy planners were actually planning or prepared to engage in nuclear war. And I think, Dan Ellsberg, I think after President Kennedy found a way to, and of course Nikita Khrushchev ultimately, in terms of his backing down, prevented a nuclear war. But I believe Kennedy came out of those intense days saying the military was mad, sort of along the lines of what you're suggesting, because, and as you mentioned, I think it's in your book, that the U.S., the war plans that you were working on called for a first strike for hitting every city, every town, over 25,000 people in both the USSR and every city in China. That's the plan.
That's right. Even in a war that began over with Russians over Cuba in 62, at that time would have led to the destruction of China as well. In fact, well, I just happened to be talking to someone this morning, who's 2 years younger than I, who, as a consultant to McGeorge Bundy, had told Bundy in 61, having toured through the region for him, that the Chinese and Soviets were more than drifting apart, that they were going into a real schism. And that was not unknown to people in the CIA, but it wasn't reflected in our war planning at all. We thought about a Sino-Soviet pact plot axis block that had to be destroyed altogether, however the war started. But to explain to your listeners, as you see, a lot of them were not even 10 at the time of 1962, that the Joint Chiefs were not in the first instance pressing for an attack on Russia. They were pressing for a non-nuclear attack, an invasion, really, first an attack on the missiles that Khrushchev had deployed to Russia, and to Cuba, and really they wanted an invasion that would overthrow Castro and would regain the island for the free nations that we control, the free, you know, which then is now sort of included Saudi Arabia and others that were no freer than they are now, and that means no freer than North Korea or anywhere else. But anyway, we would have overthrown Castro. But they did. There was always the possibility that Kennedy feared that there would be an escalation of that, possibly to Berlin. General LeMay reassured him, no, they won't. They'll be afraid to respond. It's sort of like the bloody nose planning that's being considered right now in the White House and the Pentagon, that if we had a measured, limited attack on North Korea, they would face annihilation if they responded, which is true, and thus they won't respond, which is extremely unreliable. So the idea in LeMay's mind and others was that if we attack these missiles in Cuba, which, as we thought, have no more right to be there than missiles in North Korea, the logic of that is not explicit, and it's not even too clear. But anyway, we thought we had a right to veto that deployment, even though we had, at that time, exactly comparable deployments on the borders of Russia in Turkey and elsewhere in the Mediterranean. So we were going to attack. They either would respond in a limited way or not at all. What we didn't was the theory, as in North Korea. What we didn't know was that, in fact, Cuba was, in effect, a nuclear state at that point, like North Korea now. This is the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis that a president has been threatening imminent attack on a nuclear weapon state. But then the difference was we thought those missiles were totally controlled by Moscow and that they would have the prudence and the rationality not to start an all-out war in which they'd be annihilated. What we didn't know was that Khrushchev, and he didn't tell us, was that Khrushchev had put limited range, short range nuclear weapons in Cuba. And until the president's speech of October 20th, that he had delegated authority to use those weapons to the local commanders, just as you were quoting me earlier in your introduction. Eisenhower had delegated authority, in case communications were out, to theater commanders. In fact, in other words, he'd done pretty much what we had, and he'd done this in a way that we never imagined, that a centralized tyrant dictator in Moscow would ever let go of authority of these weapons, although we had done so for ours. But he had. And if the Joint Chiefs' proposals to attack before the president's speech, instead of the president's speech, a surprise attack on their missiles before October 20th, they would have responded locally with short-range nuclear weapons against our any invasion force, which we had ready. We were gathering troops together, gathering them on troop ships, ready to go for invasion. Had those troop ships approached Cuba, they would have been hit, to our astonishment, by nuclear weapons that we didn't know were there and didn't know and couldn't even imagine had been delegated. And the response to that would have been all-out nuclear war. And what we now know, not then, was that the smoke from the cities in Russia and China and East Europe that we would have burned would have caused firestorms. There would have been firestorms. They would have lofted the smoke on fast updrafts from a firestorm into the stratosphere where it wouldn't rain out. and the smoke would circle the globe, including the southern hemisphere, and block 70% of the sunlight, killing all the harvests. The initial descriptions of nuclear winter in 1983 emphasized the lowering of temperature to ice age temperatures, freezing of lakes, freezing of rivers, which is indeed very dramatic. But more importantly, really, it would kill all the harvests, and not just for a year, but for over a decade. But humanity doesn't have stored food for a decade, or even really a year. So nearly everyone would have starved as a result of the Joint Chiefs' proposals. And to be fair here, Kennedy's first reaction on October 16th, when he was first told of the missiles being there, was that we must attack them right away. He withdrew from that, I think, within a day or two. The Joint Chiefs did not. But if he followed his own first impulses, or during the midst of that week, run along with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and many of the civilians on his executive committee of the NSC, we would not be here, because we would have starved to death. You, at 10 years old, would have been one of the first to go, because the young go sooner than the older people in these famine conditions. And there simply would be no civilization and very little humanity left.
We're speaking with Daniel Ellsberg. He's joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area. He is one of the most important whistleblowers in modern American history. I would argue the most important whistleblower. And he's also the author of The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Dan, one of the issues, you've touched on it already, but it's such an important and critical issue that you raise in the book, is that of the delegation of launch authority to theater commanders in case communications were cut off. And even then, theater commanders, you found, were delegating launch authority lower down the food chain. I think one of the things that Americans don't understand, I think they will now that you've explained this, was the high risk that we were running for many years of an accidental nuclear launch that could have really triggered a third world war, and a nuclear one at that.
Well, look, we've had a number of false alarms from our radar and satellite and electronic warning systems over the years, and Russia has too, that actually could have led to a preemptive attack to forestall a supposedly incoming attack on either side. Russia could have done that in 1983, came very close to it. We were protected, and again in the Cuban Missile Crisis earlier in 62, but again in 1995, after the Cold War under Yeltsin, that was the one time when a head of state actually contemplated the so-called football, we call it, on the computer and the briefcase that would allow him to authentically, with authority, launch a full-scale nuclear attack. And that was as recently as 1995. These alarms we just had in Hawaii and Japan were similar, except due to human error rather than a system error. But they only went to the people in Hawaii, not to the top military commands. But such alarms have gone to top military commands on both sides in the past. The delegation is very startling to learn at first to Americans who have this misimpression that the president alone has codes that lock up all the weapons. That's the way they think of it. They haven't actually ever been told that. They just assume it. They talk about codes, and they don't realize that the codes in the so-called football or briefcase that accompanies the president do nothing other than identify the sender of the message as being the president. But he's not the only one who has authority to launch these weapons under various conditions of outage of communications or very urgent circumstances. And that is true in Russia as well. When the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration talked about its plans to, quote, decapitate the Russians in the event of a war, just as we are talking now about decapitating North Korea, the Russian response was pretty foreseeable, really, though we didn't manage to foresee it. And that was to assure that we could not paralyze their response by hitting Moscow. So they instituted what was called the perimeter, or with their nickname was dead hand system, that if the central brain was hit in Moscow, there would be signals that would go off to various command centers away from Moscow, who in turn could send up rockets that would give launch orders electronically to the various missiles. In other words, you couldn't decapitate Russia without facing a massive response. Same as in the U.S., or I'm saying we didn't know it, but that was true in Cuba as well. I would say from that experience, it's almost certainly true in North Korea. When we rehearse invasion, we rehearse in attacks, and we talk about decapitation, including special forces or drones or cruise missiles of Kim Jong-un, it's almost inconceivable to me that Kim Jong-un has not made the same arrangements the others made to assure that if he is destroyed, there will be retaliation. And not necessarily just those other people, too. It could be U.S.
Daniel Ellsberg is our guest. We're talking to him about his new book. Daniel, we only have about 2 minutes left. John Kiriakou sent around an email right before we started this interview. The headline is CIA boss gives latest indication Trump is considering preemptive strike on North Korea. The first sentence, the Central Intelligence Agency is briefing President Donald Trump on the risks and opportunities of a limited attack on North Korea. Its director revealed on Tuesday, that would be today. So we have a doomsday machine now. It's not just back then. And we have the same kind of recklessness, it seems. Let's just get your opinion, because you were a nuclear war contingency planner. Given what you just said about Kim Jong-un and the likely lesson he's learned that the Russians and the Americans have, the so-called dead hand system, is it possible to have a limited attack on North Korea? Or, of course, it's possible, but what's the advisability from a military point of view of a limited attack on North Korea?
Well, in terms of advisability, let's go to an intermediate question. Yes, of course it's possible. The limited attack is possible. And of course it's possible, miracles happen, that there would be no response. The likelihood of that is not zero. It's just very close to zero. So the probability that the attack would remain limited and even remain non-nuclear, I would say, is very close to zero. It's not doomsday coming up, because North Korea alone of the 9 nuclear states doesn't have enough nuclear weapons to cause a nuclear famine that would kill. The immediate effects would involve millions, more violence than the human species has ever seen in the course of a day or a week, as would happen here. So what confirms the statement in this new book, Fire and Fury, by Michael Wolff, about which quotes, I think, a friend of Trump's, I think Bannock, who said about Trump, his friend, he's not only crazy, he's stupid. And that would be true of this attack. Which order would you give those characteristics to? This would be insane, immoral, even though it doesn't lead to the death of most people on Earth. But the attack on North Korea would be crazy, stupid, insane. And is it possible that this president would wishfully imagine that he could get away with that? Yes, I'm afraid it is possible, and that's a good deal more than zero. So it's not unlikely, and we've got to stop that.
Yeah, all the more reason people need to actually not be passive spectators, but be in the streets, and I think we'll see a lot of that in the coming weeks and months. We've been joined from San Francisco, from the San Francisco Bay Area, by Daniel Ellsberg. He is one of the most important whistleblowers. John Kiriakou says the most important whistleblower in modern American history and the author of The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner.
You know, I wanted a chance, and I was just waiting to say it at any point. To get such a tribute from John Kiriakou means a great deal to me, because John Kiriakou is, of course, an outstanding whistleblower.
God bless you,
Dan. Somebody who revealed the meaning of what those casualties over there. It means casualties to other people, not to Americans. And those other people can not only be annihilated almost costlessly, they can be tortured. Yes. The others that who are not us are people who are torturable. And that's what John Kiriakou revealed to the public. Great cost to himself.
Thank you so much,
Dan. He paid a cost that I was threatened with, and they wanted to give it to me, but by a miracle, virtually, I didn't experience that, and John Kiriakou did. So he has my greatest admiration.
I'm honored to know you, Dan. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our continued examination here at Loud and Clear of the issue of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy in the United States and U.S. policy, we are pleased to broadcast today an interview with two leading experts in the field of nuclear power. This interview took place on January 10th, 2018. In the studio is Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group from New Mexico, here lobbying in Washington, D.C. And we're also joined by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. Welcome back, Greg and Kevin.
Thank you.
Let's talk about, you know, in our last segment, we were focusing on nuclear weapons. We were focusing on what's going on between the United States and North Korea, how much money has been spent on nuclear weapons. Just this last week, however, Rick Perry, Secretary of Energy's panel review that was demanding that there be subsidies for the nuclear and coal industry, the panel of experts who were appointed by the Trump administration said no to the subsidy of nuclear power. Of course, we had Three Mile Island. The world knows about Chernobyl, the danger of from Fukushima, all of the tragedies, catastrophic tragedies from nuclear energy and nuclear power plants. But where is it going, Kevin Camps? I mean, it seems also part of the consideration from the panel, maybe the primary one, wasn't about health and safety or the environment. It had more to do with the business side of nuclear power plants.
Right. So this was the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And it does have a majority of Trump directors now at this point. And despite all that, we just won a victory against the nuclear lobby just in the last couple of days, where FERC, as it's called, decided not to go forward with this Energy Secretary Perry proposed bailout scheme, which one of the FERC commissioners, the previous acting chairman, Chatterjee, who's a former aide to Mitch McConnell, so a huge coal fan for one thing, but also a nuclear power fan, was calling it a lifeboat, a lifeline, life support for these two dirty, dangerous, and expensive energy industries that are wreaking havoc upon the climate in the case of coal. And you mentioned some of the nuclear disasters that, you know, have done some damage to this planet too, with massive radioactivity releases. So Chatterjee was all for it, but despite that, this decision came down that they're not going to go forward. Now, the asterisk on this victory, and it is a victory because they wanted to get away with it, but there were, for example, Nuclear Information Resource Service alone generated 25,000 public comments against this idea. And then you add it to tens of thousands more from Public Citizen and Sierra Club, and we stopped it for now. The danger, though, because the nuclear lobby does not go away, the coal lobby does not go away, the danger is that this is going to get kicked to the regional transmission organizations like PJM, which stands for Pennsylvania, Jersey, and Mid-Atlantic. Maryland, yes, Mid-Atlantic, Maryland. It's Maryland. But PJM actually extends to Illinois. So it's the biggest electricity grid system in our country. And unfortunately, it is controlled by the electric utilities and, you know, and the lobbies from these industries. And so they're going to try again in this even more obscure realm of the regional transmission organizations. So we're going to have to stay vigilant. And as has been the case for several years now, we've got to stop these subsidies from flowing, because what they're doing is they're, you know, continuing this climate catastrophe caused by coal and other fossil fuels. And in the nuclear realm, these old reactors in this country are disasters waiting to happen. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that's supposed to ensure safety at Atomic Reactors is not only a captured agency, they are a rogue agency. So we have 100 operating reactors in this country, many of which are now not 40 years old. Some of them are approaching a half century. One of those, for example, is Oyster Creek, New Jersey, that fired up in December of 1969. That age-related degradation could lead to an American Fukushima.
And the Fukushima plant, is it similar to what we have here in the United States in terms of the model?
Fukushima Daiichi, the six reactors there were General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors. And as Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates has put it, many of the bad decisions that led to the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe were made in California by General Electric and its contractors. Things like removing tens of feet of elevation at the site to save money on pumping cooling water that then left the site wide open to that tsunami that caused three reactor meltdowns and nearly caused a high-level radioactive waste storage pool fire. And if that latter had happened, and it almost did, it did not happen because of sheer luck. The acting prime minister at the time, Khan, has said he had a secret contingency plan to evacuate up to 50 million people 50 million people from northeastern Japan if that massive catastrophe had unfolded. And what has unfolded is a massive catastrophe, but dwarfed by what could have happened. And so we have nearly three dozen reactors of the exact same design or a very similar design, the Mark II, in the United States. I mentioned Oyster Creek, New Jersey, approaching a half century in age. It is a General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor. So the good news of these record-breaking numbers of reactor shutdowns in the United States in the last few years, places like Vermont Yankee, a very hard-won victory, that also was a GE Mark I reactor. By definition, it cannot now have a reactor core meltdown because the fuel has come out of the core, but it's been moved into the storage pool. And some more good news at Vermont Yankee is that that pool of high-level radioactive waste is being emptied at a relatively fast clip into safer, still not safe, dry cask storage on site. But we have pools at places like Oyster Creek and elsewhere that are full to the gills. And if they go up in flames, remember that figure, 50 million people would have to have been evacuated from northeast Japan.
Kevin, the UK government earlier this week announced that they had reached a point where 50% of the energy that's generated domestically, it comes from wind. The UK has been a heavily nuclear energy country for at least a half a century, maybe longer than half a century. Is there any reason why the United States can't get to something like that?
Not at all. I mean, you have groundbreaking work by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Dr. Arjun Makajani. Back in 2007, he published a book called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for the U.S. Energy Economy. And his thesis in 2007 was in the next 40 years or less, depending on political will, we could replace fossil fuels and nuclear completely from our economy for the same percentage of our gross domestic product as we currently spend on these dirty, dangerous, and expensive industries, and do it through renewable energy and through efficiency. The United States, given its geography, its large size, two coastlines, the sun of Arizona and Florida, we have more renewable resources than most countries in the world, including a place like Germany. Germany has made the decision to go renewable and efficient. They're going to turn off the last atomic reactor in 2022. That's a direct response to Fukushima. They're going to largely phase out fossil fuels by mid-century. We're talking 85% reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by getting rid of fossil fuels. And how are they doing this? They're doing it through maximized efficiency, which they've had for a long time, and they're doing it through renewable development. The thing is, Germany is far to the north of most of the United States.
Less and cloudy, something like 300 days a year.
Less solar potential, less coastlines for offshore wind, for sure. Less land.
Or tidal energy.
Yeah, less land mass for onshore wind. So if Germany can do it, the United States can do it. Germany is the fourth largest economy in the world. The United States is the first. The United States could make this happen in a relatively quick period of time if it chose to.
Whatever happened to T. Boone Pickens' plan to turn northern Texas into into the largest wind farm in the world. Why did that never come to fruition?
Well, it kind of did, actually.
Did it?
West Texas is one of the largest growth areas for on-land wind power in the world, if you look at it on a regional basis. So I just happened to drive through West Texas several months ago, and the wind farms are large scale. They're often located on the tops of mesas, and it's very large scale. So, you know, there was recent news coverage in the last few months of a very conservative town in Texas called Georgetown, I believe, and they are as red can be politically. And for economic reasons, they decided to mostly go with wind. They're going to save so much money as a community doing this, and they're tapping into that West Texas wind supply. And that was a point I wanted to make about Germany, too. The conservatives have ruled Germany for several years now under Merkel. And their point is, yeah, it saves the climate. That's pretty important when you live on this planet, to have a habitable planet to live on. But more important for the German Conservative Party is this is priming them to be the world leader in renewables, at least in the Western world, if not in the entire world. China's got some ideas about this, too. And so the United States is missing a huge business opportunity. We're going to get left in the dust by countries like Germany and China and others when it comes to wind power, solar power efficiency.
Greg Mello, jump in if you would. Your focus is nuclear weapons, the Los Alamos Study Group, but this is integrated, and it's been integrated from the beginning, since the Manhattan Project. So go ahead.
Sure. This is a national security consideration of the first magnitude for the United States, and we are really missing the boat. It's painful. I was in a congressional hearing yesterday. It's very painful to hear Congress people talking about our abundant fossil fuel energy, which they would like to uncork and release on the world, on the climate. But besides that, it isn't abundant. It's not so abundant. It might be abundant if you could sell oil at $150 a barrel. But at today's prices, it's finite, very finite. And to produce all that natural gas means fracking the whole country. I mean, you have to replace these wells every couple of years. They have about a 60% decline rate in the first year. So it's not a recipe that's sustainable economically, climatically, environmentally. From the business perspective, it's completely dependent on unrealistically low interest rates. And there's a bankruptcy business model where executives get paid a lot and then they go bankrupt. So investors live, you know, that's how the system works.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting part of it, because the people in charge, they're going to get bailed out. They're going to have a golden parachute no matter what, even if the business model is not sustainable. And meanwhile, society has to live with the consequences.
And unfortunately, it maps very closely onto the Republican-Democrat divide in the country, so that you've got basically these factions which are driving the bus. And we hate to see partisanship in the climate debate. And we think that Democrats should really reach across the aisle and begin building bridges with Republicans, because I don't think we can go forward any other way. There's a link. Nuclear power stations are, of course, prime targets in war, are kind of pre-emplaced nuclear weapons, but they really contain a lot more radioactivity than a nuclear weapon. So when people think, oh, it's a big blast, a lot of radiation, but it's dwarfed by like 100 times by the radioactivity that is in storage at these sites already.
Oh, that's an important fact. I mean, the National Surveillance State justifies its existence in its all-encompassing, comprehensive, and I'd say unconstitutional data collection against of the American people and all people on the basis of keeping us safe, keeping the country safe. But that's an excellent point. I mean, the nuclear power plants themselves, with all of this stored radioactivity, they can't really be protected. And certainly the NSA mass data collection of our emails isn't doing a thing to protect that.
That's a really important point. I mentioned the pools at Fukushima Daiichi that almost went up in flames. And so in the United States, we have 100 of these pools at operating atomic reactors and at closed atomic reactors, where the pools are just kept full of irradiated nuclear fuel. And they're not even located inside containment structures. At least reactors are inside containments. We saw that containments...
How could that be?
it saved a lot of money for the industry.
So it's really, it's private profit-driven corporations deciding to cut corners because they can reward themselves and their investors and attract more capital because their investment return is higher. So they're cutting corners and they're running the show.
And what the anti-nuclear and environmental movement of this country has been calling for 15 plus years is hardened on-site storage for that waste. Get it out of the pools that could go up in flames if attacked or if there's an accident, if there's a natural disaster, get it out of the pools into dry cask storage on site because there's nowhere else to go right now, as close as possible to the point of generation, and fortify it against attacks, safeguard it against accidents and natural disasters. And as you just said, none of these things are happening in order to save the industry money. And it's with the blessing of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and, unfortunately, with a derelict Congress whose job it is to oversee the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So we are, living on borrowed time.
Let's not forget the state regulatory bodies, which have the electricity rates primary in their mind, and as was said, making it possible for investors to profitably invest in these nuclear plants. And they are the ones that make the decisions to keep these things running under these conditions, which would really shock people if they understood.
Yeah, it would shock. It's shocking me. And I thought I knew something, but because we treat things like this as a commodity, in other words, part of the marketplace, part of generating profit for an investor class, and those needs come first. That's the priority. But we're talking about not just a normal commodity. We're talking about commodities and the byproducts of the commodities that can wipe out human life and all living things for large parts of the country or large parts of the planet. I mean, here you have $7, $8, $9 trillion being spent for more nuclear weapons, but we're not building sort of storage facilities that are adequate to prevent these kind of catastrophic accidents. I mean, I think the American people truly just basically don't know.
That's it. They don't know. I think that this is when people listen to this conversation, they're going to be shocked by some of these details because people don't know.
You know, one phrase I'd like to get out on the table is this notion of a just transition. And this applies as much at Los Alamos National Laboratory as it does at the Palisades Atomic Reactor in Michigan, where I'm from. We do care about the nuclear workers. We would like to see these facilities transformed, in the case of Los Alamos, into peaceful purposes instead of atomic weaponry. And we'd like to see at Palisades a shutdown of this catastrophe waiting to happen and its replacement with renewables, for example. And just to give you an idea of how twisted things are right now, we've been talking about the bailout attempts to keep old reactors running. Unfortunately, we were not able to stop this in New York State under Governor Cuomo, who did good work on demanding the shutdown of the Indian Point nuclear power plant, which is very near New York City. And that's supposed to take place in 2020 and 2021. There are two reactors there. But the raw political deal that went into that, Cuomo himself led the charge to keep several upstate New York reactors on the Lake Ontario shoreline operating, supposedly to keep the employees in jobs. As we've been talking about, some of these facilities are nearly 50 years old. There are accidents waiting to happen. And in order to make that happen, $7.5 billion of ratepayer money was thrown at these atomic reactors over the course of the next decade or so. That is clean energy money that was supposed to go towards renewables and efficiency. That's New York. In Illinois, the same thing went down, just a little bit less money, $2.5 billion of ratepayer money to keep several old, dangerous atomic reactors operating, with, again, not only Republican support, like the governor, but even Democratic state legislators went for that one. They're trying to get away with this across the country. In Michigan at Palisades, just how twisted this all is, the company, Entergy, said it was going to shut down Palisades on January of 2019. I'm sorry, October of 2018, coming up. And they reversed their decision. And the reason was they had asked for kind of a severance package from the State Public Service Commission, as Greg mentioned, of close to $200 million, and they only got about $150 million. So they were shortchanged about $30 million bucks. And as Tim Judson at Nuclear Information and Resource Service has put it, these companies, that's like pocket change. They could have found that amount of money in the couch cushions if they had looked for it. So because they didn't get all they wanted from the state, they've decided to just stick by their guns and keep running this perhaps most dangerous atomic reactor in the country on the shoreline of Lake Michigan, the drinking water supply for 15 million people. And we'll see how this goes.
Greg Mello, go ahead.
Sure. This just transition idea is very important because it's not only the moral thing to do, but it's also politically necessary. But in the case of the nuclear weapons laboratories, it's quite complex and difficult. About 25 years ago, we started the study group with the idea that we could convert the weapons labs to peaceful research. I worked on this for 3 years, 4 years, and then again, a few years later, we worked on Livermore again, and we discovered that the barriers were enormous, and all kinds of barriers. So the way that we would manage that these days is through retirements. There's very generous retirements that are offered, and incentives for people to work in civilian industry if they left these facilities. So you could manage a transition. You could get a lot more economic development out of it when there, Ann Markeson and her group has done a lot, did a lot on this in the 1990s. So when people leave these very specialized weapons facilities and go to work in the civilian economy, as happened in Seattle when Boeing had a big downturn, they went into the software industry and really boosted Seattle's economy. More than Boeing had done.
This is an important piece to it because the idea of jobs will also always be thrown in the face of those who are saying for societal reasons, for environmental reasons, for common sense reasons, these facilities should be closed down. But somebody will say, but what about the workers? Same with the coal miners. Like, there should be an absolute pledge of conversion so that jobs that are lost because the industries need to be closed, that those workers are not the ones who are punished. Society and government at state legislatures or the federal government, it would be easily done to make a pledge to workers who are displaced that they have conversion, either very ample retirement plans or going into civilian industry. In the 1980s, the new president at that time of the International Association of Machinists, and the Machinists Union had a lot of jobs in the military and a lot of jobs inside of the nuclear industry. They argued that these things should be shut down, but that the machinist membership should be given jobs, that society should give them jobs. That's the easy and obvious and rational answer, rather than saying on Lake Ontario, we're going to keep a nuclear plant going that could annihilate the entire region so that the workers who are there don't lose their jobs. I mean, that's just obviously bizarre and absurd logic, except no one wants to make a commitment to conversion.
Well, and it really leads to all kinds of crazy stuff. So at Los Alamos National Laboratory, during the what's it called, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act period, after the big, not after the big recession, but as a result of the 2008 downturn, there was an enhanced environmental cleanup program going on there, and it created jobs. You had to spend about $1 million to make a job, a single job. And then the waste was dug up from one place and then carted by truck to another mesa in Los Alamos and buried, and other waste was carted to Utah and buried. It was a net environmental gain, but it was nothing like the environmental gain that one could have had, and it was extremely inefficient in creating jobs. And there's a kind of a salary premium at a lot of these sites, which can't be matched. So at the weapons labs, people can't go from there to other jobs and make $100,000, $200,000 a year for being a mediocre physicist. It's very easy to become a millionaire as a nuclear weapons scientist. About 1 in 11 households in Los Alamos are cash millionaires, not counting the value of their homes. Very easy to accumulate that kind of money, and you can't duplicate it in the civilian economy.
Wow.
I wasn't thinking about the millionaires. I was thinking about other people in the in the job structures, because there obviously have to be not at the top, but there's a lot of workers, a lot of people in construction and engineering who are not making, you know, that kind of money. Anyway, let's talk in our last few minutes, because we're talking about nuclear accident possibilities, and we have 4 minutes, and it's just a matter of time, actually, before there's the next nuclear accident.
Sure.
It's just a matter of time.
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable. So this is not like some sort of rhetorical flourish. This is real. I want to talk about that because I think it's, not to be alarmist, but it's alarming, and I think we should talk about it. And also the same goes for nuclear weapons accidents, because there's been a couple times, maybe more than a few times, where the society or our planet was almost, or big parts of it, almost annihilated because of nuclear weapons accidents.
And oftentimes those accidents are classified. And so either the information never gets out or it gets out 20 or 30 years after the fact.
So let's break this last 3.5 minutes up in two parts. Let's deal first with the nuclear weapons, a nuclear power plant and the nuclear energy industry. What are the big dangers there? Let's do 1.5 minutes and then go, Greg Mello, to talk about nuclear weapons accidents.
Well, we have 100 operating atomic reactors in the United States. There's 20 or about that in Canada. And there are so many pathways to catastrophe at these facilities. And for that reason alone, the age-related degradation is a growing factor. We are in uncharted waters with these reactors, with a rogue nuclear regulatory commission that is complicit with risk-taking and the taking of shortcuts to boost profits. So we're really living on borrowed time. As I mentioned, getting the waste out of the pools, even at the shutdown reactors where it's still stored, is a huge upgrade in safety that needs to be done in a prompt, careful way. As is happening at the ruined Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, they are very carefully getting the irradiated nuclear fuel out of these destroyed reactors in the pools where it still presents a danger. So one last thing I'd like to say quickly is that nuclear power is not atoms for peace. That is a deception. And so any claim of transition from nuclear weapons into nuclear power needs to be taken with a very large grain of salt, because nuclear power can lead to nuclear weapons and is itself a huge catastrophic risk.
Excellent points. That's Kevin Camps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. Greg Mello, last word with you. Nuclear weapons accidents, it's real. Also real.
It's very real. And there are overt accidents, and then there are structural chronic precursors to accidents which we can't understand except in historical retrospect. So in the Cuban Missile Crisis, there were a lot more things that could have gone wrong than even the most informed participants at the time knew about, because knowledge wasn't perfect. We've got postures which people make, and we have the soft and hard power of an empire at stake in these confrontations. And steps can be taken which only in hindsight could be irreversible, seen as irreversible. So you might have – so much is made of Trump's impetuousness, which is, I think, important and accurate. But there's also the inexorable stuff that goes on, the – coup d'etat in Ukraine, fomented under Hillary Clinton by Victoria Nuland. That is something which becomes the foundation for conflict. It's the Russiagate narrative, which is being pushed here in the city. Stephen F. Cohen rightly remarks that this is one of the most dangerous things that's happened, because it sets the stage for confrontation and makes every crisis worse. So We've had a lot of nuclear weapons accidents, but I wouldn't focus on those technical managerial accidents. I would focus on the ones which come from policy and which come quite from miscalculation of intent and folly.
And there's been so many miscalculations. We're going to wrap it up, but so many miscalculations. When you think about Iraq, when you think about Libya, when you think about that axis of evil speech and North Korea being added on, so many, you know, really powerful miscalculations. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined in our Washington, D.C. studio by Greg Mello. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group in New Mexico. And we've been joined by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.